Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. Today, I am at home. Rob is in America. But because of the time difference, we weren't able to get together on the same Skype call to record the intro and the outro to today's show. So I'm doing it today. At the moment, it's 10:27 on Friday. Rob will be fast asleep. But I'm going to try and leave some gaps for Rob to interject and say hello to you all, which he'll pre-record in 5 hours when he wakes up. Actually, you're an early, probably going to be 3 hours when you wake up. So Rob, how's it going?
Good, Dan. You're right. I am an early bird. It is only 3 hours late.
I'm not sure how long to leave.
That'll do.
Maybe if you do this in one take, it'll be funnier because Sometimes I'll maybe interrupt you and other times I'll probably leave slightly too long a gap.
You know me.
So apologies to any listeners. So what are you doing in America?
We're just on holiday. But I met Mark on the flight over here.
Enjoying it?
Yeah. It's very sunny. It is now. We're in Savannah.
What have you done anything interesting? Been to see any jazz? That's probably unlikely.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, Steve Coleman. We went to the Village Vanguard on Sunday night. Saw Steve play.
I'm going to guess that your answer was no, I didn't see any jazz.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, it was amazing.
But you did
amazing.
Meet someone who, on the plane over, do you want to tell us what happened, Rob? I'll leave a little gap here for you.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. So I was sitting in my seat and queuing for the toilet. Right in front of me was Mark Lockhart, but I didn't notice him until there was about an hour left of the flight. He was sitting three rows behind me the entire time, and we hadn't realized. And I'd sat and edited his show, like, right next to him.
Crazy. So you met Mark Lockhart, who's on today's episode, on your flight.
Yeah.
So what happened with the retweet on the toilet thing?
Oh, yeah. I just tweeted a photo of us, stood next to the toilet. Hashtag toilets for a laugh, and then some weird Twitter account.
I hope I timed my laugh right. I'm sure you said something funny.
Yeah, I did.
So today we're on the show. We've got Mark Lockhart, as you've probably guessed by the title and by that story. Shall we press play, Rob?
Let's do it.
Yeah? Let's do it.
Here he comes. Mark Lockhart. Doing?
I'm good. Thank you, Rob.
So let's get straight in on where you grew up.
Okay, I grew up in the New Forest.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, grew up in the New Forest and then moved away to Portsmouth area. And then I lived for a year in America because my dad's job took him to America for a year assignment. So we all went as a family to America.
That's awesome. Was it awesome?
It was awesome. It was awesome for lots of reasons, but it was awesome because my dad brought a saxophone when he was out there.
Right.
And my dad always wanted to learn. And that's the reason why I started learning is he got this saxophone and I thought, oh, that looks like fun.
Yeah.
So I kind of said to him, can I borrow it, you know. So we shared this saxophone, and I had started to get lessons at my school in America. So my first year of playing the saxophones, the saxophone was in America, in upstate New York.
Wow.
So that's a big deal, really cool. Living that's... there, you know. Yeah.
Do you think there's any chance that he would never have bought a sax if you hadn't have moved to America?
Yeah, I mean, he used to play the drums, but he sold the drums to take my mum out, so the story goes. I mean, it seems a bit of a shame. But he was always interested in music, my dad. I mean, he was passionate about music. He played music all the time in the house. So I think it was only a matter of time until he did, you know, take up another instrument or start the drums again.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, it was the saxophone that he brought in America, and that's the one that I started on, yeah.
So, wow.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you and him, were you like both getting lessons?
Yeah, it was quite mad because we were both beginners at the same time.
Yeah.
And when we came back from America, we had the same teacher, a guy on the South Coast. He was a good saxophone player, actually, called Terry Stewart, and he played the baritone mainly, and he was obsessed with Jerry Mulligan. So he used to do these Jerry Mulligan tunes, and me and my dad were in his band. So I was in at the same band with my dad for quite a while.
Yeah.
When I was about 13, 14, we were playing together in this band. So, I kind of owe a lot to my dad, you know. And my dad still plays
amazing
as a semi-pro, and he's got a little quartet and he does a big band.
So how old was he when he started? Because that's really cool that he's, like, got a quartet and a big band and everything.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Well, that was 40 years ago, so I guess he's, how old is he now? He must have been, like, mid-40s.
Yeah.
Mid to late 40s when that was happening.
Yeah.
And he worked for IBM, and he didn't really like working for IBM. Found it all a bit boring. Music was his passion.
Yeah.
And that's why he went out and got the saxophone, I think. So, yeah, it was kind of cool, really. And my first teacher was this kind of American bandsman, you know, who was into kind of American marching bands and things.
Cool.
But it was good, you know. He knew how to blow it, and he knew how to get a good embouchure and things like that.
Yeah.
So then after a year of that assignment, we came back, and it just kind of carried on, really, and I played with my dad, and...
Do you ever still play with him?
I haven't played with him for years, no. Right. I mean, I would if the opportunity
arose. Yeah, if he needs a debt in the band.
Well, I say I don't play. I don't do gigs with him, but I often take my sax down when I go and see my folks because both my parents are still alive, luckily. And I take his saxophone down there and we play duos and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
But we haven't done a gig for a long time.
That sounds...
You know.
Yeah, that sounds cool though.
But I mean, he was every Sunday morning I can remember there'd be music, you know, jazz music blaring out.
Yeah.
He'd crank it up and have it really loud, and he'd have, you know, Frank Sinatra and Ella and Dave Brubeck and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's quite cool hearing all that and being around all that music, you know, when you're so young.
Yeah, definitely. I think that inevitably has a massive, impact on how you end up
as
a musician, you know? Those are things that you're listening to before you even know you're listening, you know, and it's just on and you're just soaking it up.
Yeah, you just absorb it. I mean, I kind of think that's how you learn the music best anyway, just absorbing it, you know?
Yeah.
So for me, it was really important, that absorption process. You know, and that carried on for years and years and years, you know.
Yeah.
Still does, really. And I can remember putting my dad's records on and just playing along with them for hours, you know.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like transcription, I suppose, isn't it? You know, but I wasn't really aware of doing any transcription. I was just putting the record on, turning it up loud, and playing along with it.
Yeah.
And imagining that I was in the studio with these guys.
Yeah.
in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
Whatever it was, you know. So, and I realise now how important that was, that process, you know.
I think that gets overlooked a little bit now, personally.
Yeah, I think it does. I say to students, I say, so do you play along to CDs or Spotify? And sometimes they look at me a bit blankly, like, oh, why would I want to do that, you know?
Mm.
And to me, you kind of learn everything that way. You learn the sound, you learn the phrasing, you learn the feel, and you learn the language, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, why wouldn't you want to play along?
Yeah. I remember the one I was always most jealous of was the housemate John Ormston, who's a drummer, used to play along with the Kenny Wheeler album, What Now?, which is without drums on to begin with. So, like, it's Kenny Wheeler and John Taylor, Chris Potter and Dave Holland. And John would just play kit along to it, like adding in the drum part. I thought it was beautiful, like a -1 play along.
Yeah. Yeah, well, why not? Exactly. It's a great idea. I mean, those Impulse Coltrane records are quite fun because the way the stereo is that you can take out Coltrane pretty much
from one channel. Yeah.
And you can just blow along with McCoy Tyner Trio.
Sweet. That's amazing.
So I remember doing that quite a lot.
Yeah.
And you can just about hear him in the little famous thing, but basically you're there with McCoy Tyner.
That's amazing.
Doing a session, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's good.
That's hilarious.
Mm.
So after this, so you move back and you're on the South Coast and you're learning with the guy who's really into Jerry Mulligan.
Yes.
And then what happens?
Then I started to do loads of gigs, kind of function gigs, because the South Coast where I lived, there were loads of gigs basically on piers and holiday camps and all that kind of stuff.
This is before the days of budget airlines.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it is, because I guess this is mid-70s,
yeah.
I suppose. Yeah, because I went to college in 79. So yeah, I was working all the time. Before I went to college, I was working, doing these show bands, you know, playing alto in these show bands. And, I mean, it was pretty mind-numbing, some of it, but looking back, it was really good for me. You know, it made me really strong, I think, as a player and things like that, you know. And it was good for my reading and it was good for my sound and all those kind of things. And I was earning some money, which is brilliant, you know.
Yeah.
And I did that from about, a lot of that from about 15 to, or say 16 to 18. I did a lot of that kind of work.
Yeah.
You know, I'd play jazz a lot as well with friends and things like that, but that commercial work was really good for me, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really satisfying that if you sound good, you can earn money. You don't, like, need your degree first, you know.
Mm.
I had a few friends who were at Manchester University at medical school when I was studying, and I was always so thrilled that I could go and do what I was studying, like, and earn out of it, which you can't do some like surgery just like
part-time surgery.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I remember thinking, right, I can get something out of this situation, even though it's playing YMCA medley again for a load of people at Pontins or something.
Yeah,
you know, I just remember thinking, well, I can get something out of this, you know. When I was 16, I'm going to get something out of this, you know, and I did.
Yeah.
So I think it's about attitude, isn't it?
I think that's the thing with functions. You've got to try and find ways to challenge yourself.
Mm.
And that, like you say, that attitude, if you've decided it's a waste of your time, then it certainly will be. Mm. I used to do like, remember my sax teacher, Andy Scott, had shown me a lot of slightly like altered fingerings for like a middle D. He would hold his B key down.
Right.
Just so it didn't get slightly sharp.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, hey, I could just try those all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that'll give me something to do for an hour.
Yeah.
Try not to miss any of those notes and like,
yeah.
You know, experiment with that thing.
Yeah. No, I think it's all about that. It's all about your attitude to learning and getting something out of a situation. It's massively important.
Yeah. So where did you study? Or what did you study?
I studied... Well, I kind of wanted to study jazz, but the only place in 79 was Leeds, and I didn't really want to go to Leeds. I wanted to be in London.
Yeah.
So I went to Trinity College of Music and studied classical saxophone and clarinet.
Cool.
So that's what I did.
Yeah. Who did you study with?
I studied with a guy called Chris Gradwell.
Right.
Who was in the London Saxophone Quartet. And when I was there, it was really good for a while, and I played a lot of the repertoire. And then I realised there wasn't a lot of great repertoire for the saxophone, unlike the clarinet, you know, where you've got Brahms and you've got all this amazing stuff.
Yeah, I can only imagine, because even I did the same thing.
Mm.
And for me, I was a like contemporary saxophone student in the like 2006 kind of, you know, and a lot of our repertoire then was stuff that had been written in like the 90s, like all really recent.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Well, there was, I guess, what was there? You know, there's the Glazunov and there's the Paul Creston and things like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, some of it's a little bit wretched,
really. Yeah, yeah, you just...
And now you get some good... There's quite a lot of good stuff, isn't there? Now.
Yeah, it's much more interesting, but I totally feel your feelings of... being aware that our repertoire was way thinner, you know, and that even some of the stuff you have, I kind of felt like it was in there just because there wasn't much else.
Yeah.
You know, and then you've got the clarinet and you've got Mozart and Beethoven. Amazing. I mean, stuff. It's no comparison.
No, no. I think that was the thing. I mean, I kind of knew that before I went, but...
I was thinking that listeners are going to be like, yeah, but you both chose to do that.
but, you know, within a year, it was kind of obvious that... It had a kind of ceiling. So I was into jazz. I mean, I was always into jazz, so that's what I wanted to do, play jazz. And I remember my first lesson with this classical teacher. I went in with my Otto Link, and he said, oh, you can't play that. You can't play classical music with that.
Yeah.
And he was kind of right, but he was a bit brutal about it, you know.
Yeah.
So I had to go and get a Selmer.
A C-Star.
Which we all have to have.
I sold mine and I really regret it now.
Oh, yeah.
This is a stupid thing to do. I sold it in, like, an act of rebellion.
Yeah.
Farewell,
leaving C-Star. That life behind.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. I've needed it a few times since.
Mm.
Bad life choice.
But, you know, at Trinity, it was interesting because there were lots of jazz musicians there when I was there.
Yeah.
There was Simon Purcell, who was in a couple of years above me. Martin Speak was there. Julian Arguelles came towards the end of when I was there. So it was, you know, there were all these kind of jazz musicians wrestling to kind of play jazz.
Yeah.
So we did.
Yeah.
Even though we weren't meant to.
Yeah. You know? Is this how the Loose Tubes thing kind of came out of this, like, collective... will to play jazz?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I the Loose Tubes thing happened kind of just after college, really. So we were... I was very lucky with that, to get involved in that. But yeah, towards the end of Trinity, I started playing with people like Steve Berry. Steve Berry had a band called Let's Eat. And... it was called Let's Eat because we used to sit around having long lunches and playing a bit and then, you know, having some more to eat and tea and stuff. And
yeah.
So it was quite sedate. Although we did work very hard, and Steve wrote all the music, and it was the first kind of small band that I was in, really.
Yeah.
And it was with John Paricelli and a drummer called Dave Patman.
Right.
And... so what happened, and I knew Django a bit. I'd had a few blows with Django and some other people, so I knew Django a bit. But what happened is Graham Collier, who I'd done a few gigs with because he used to have a big band, he asked some people, basically, four or five people, to recommend some people to get together for a rehearsal. for a rehearsal band.
Right.
And so the five people he asked kind of knew various people. So I think Steve Berry, I think he knew Graham. I certainly knew Graham. But anyway, that's kind of how the band formed, was the people saying, oh, get so-and-so. Get, you know, he's great. Get so-and-so.
Yeah.
I know him. I've played with him.
Yeah.
So for the very first rehearsal of that band, it was these people who were all kind of little groups. You know, they'd worked together a little bit and
yeah.
had little bands together. It's kind of how it came about, really. So Graham didn't really choose the people. It was the musicians that he'd asked chose the rest of the people.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So we got to the first rehearsal and then there was all of Let's Eat there.
Great.
So it was like, there was our band. There was Django and his kind of band at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. And then, you know, other people. Tim Whitehead was there. And he knew Nick France, who was the original drummer, you know, because Nick played with Tim Whitehead. So there were all these connections, yeah. you know. So it was yeah. Lots of bands within a band, really.
Yeah.
But it was amazing. And we kind of, we started to rehearse the first tune. Oh, no, that's right. The first few rehearsals, I think, Graham had music. Graham Collier had mm-hmm. this music, which was fine.
Yeah.
It wasn't particularly something that everyone was into, but, you know, we played it, and I think there was a John Warren tune we did. And then the next week, Django brought in a tune called Eden Express, and we played it, and it was just like, it was amazing, you know. It was just like, oh, okay, this is a brilliant chart, you know.
It's, yeah.
It's hip, it's very different from all the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the whole kind of feeling of the band was like, yeah, this is great, you know. And then yeah. he brought another one in the week after, and then Steve Berry brought a tune in called Mr. Z. And then kind of what happened then, I think we all realised that we preferred the music that the guys in the band were writing, more yeah. than Graham's music and some of the older jazz things, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how it happened. People brought tunes in and we rehearsed, and within a few months, we were rehearsing every Monday, religiously. We used to get together every Monday, in Greenwich, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. There used to be a studio, no longer there, up on the river, called Woodwharf Studios, and we'd meet there every Monday and play. I think it was like all day, actually. I think it was about 10 till 4 or 10 till 5.
Yeah.
So it was an amazing thing, amazing kind of commitment everyone had for it.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. It's a really hard thing to achieve.
Yeah.
Every week, same day, same times, you know, and everyone's got a kind of, I don't know how it was then, but the first thing I think is, you know, that you also have to not get paid for the rehearsal, and that you're not going to be able to earn anything if you're going to be, or at least, you know, it takes a kind of, it does take a big commitment, you know.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you can't.
Yeah.
London's such an expensive place.
Mm. I mean, I guess it's the same problems as now. You know, as now, you have to earn a living. And
yeah.
We were all teaching as well, probably.
Yeah.
To get money.
Yeah.
And Monday meant that you couldn't teach. You had to dep it out. You know, so it was a huge commitment, really.
Yeah, if I thought about trying that now... the logistical implications.
No, I know. Yeah, it's amazing, really, when you think about it. But this carried on, you know, and then we did our first gig with it at the Prince of Orange in Rotherhithe, which was a pub
yeah.
in those days. It's now apartments, I think.
Right.
But we did this gig, and it was like, it was a big, big success, you know.
Yeah.
And we were very lucky to get involved with this guy called Colin Lazzarini, who became our manager. And he was very, very important for the success of that band, you know.
Yeah.
I think without him, I don't think much would have happened, really.
Right.
He was great, you know. He got all the press down and he kind of... and he was with us for, well, to the end, really. He kind of managed the band.
Yeah. Steve Berry came on our show a few months ago.
Yeah.
And he described it as like the whole group of people getting together and then without a manager... Everyone would have sort of pointed somewhere and gone, hey, look, let's go that way. And then they'd have just gone.
It's quite good, yeah. A load of sheep, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without a direction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about, you know, it was, there wasn't a really a leader in it. You know, it was a kind of cooperative, really.
Yeah.
But everyone looked to Django in a way. In a kind of musical way, you know.
Yeah, I reckon that's an inevitable.
I mean, it's always going to happen.
Yeah,
yeah, and the fact that he's so amazing. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, it wasn't really anyone's band, but I guess the writers. So the writers were Django, Steve Berry, Chris Batchelor, wrote some stuff.
Eddie yeah. Mark,
you know, they were the kind of co-leaders, if you like, of that band. You know,
yeah.
But there was no. There was no structure to change anything. So that's one of the problems that happened in the end is there was no structure to kind of change personnel or...
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So it kind of...
I'd have loved to have written like legislation and like voting and...
Yeah.
You know, you could have gotten a really like complex political system.
Yeah. Well, we did used to have meetings and vote on everything.
Right.
You know.
Wow, cool.
And it was just majority, whatever, you know,
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it got very painful at times.
Yeah.
That, you know.
And so, personal, I guess.
Yeah, and yeah. personal. It got, so it kind of, in the end, it kind of tore itself apart a bit. You know,
yeah.
Which was a shame.
Yeah. Did you do the 20th anniversary?
Yeah. Gig? That was good fun, yeah.
Was it?
It was great, yeah. Yeah.
I can imagine that it would be really surreal. I can't imagine at all, but... I'd like to think that, you know, that kind of getting back together again. And,
it was, know, yeah, it was really good fun.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, the first day of rehearsal when we got back together, it was just like, just social, you know, everyone was just, we didn't get much music. We were yeah. just kind of getting to know each other again.
Yeah. I had a band collapse because of that once where as we got to, like, as we graduated and we spent less time together, when we did spend time together, we'd be so keen to just chat and mess about. And then the tipping point came one day where we all got together to rehearse and just didn't play anything. And you're kind of like, I think this is it. You know, let's all just shake hands and be friends now. You're kind of...
It's funny, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So when Loose Tubes ended, I guess that had helped you to sort of establish yourself in town and, you know, like... find lots of stuff to do. I guess you were doing loads of other things as well while that was running.
I was doing a few things, yeah. I was always playing with different people and, you know, and I liked that. I was playing with a trombonist called Annie Whitehead in her band. We used to do a lot of gigs. That was happening when Loose Tubes was happening.
Yeah.
She had a deal with Virgin. So, you know, she was kind of... potentially quite successful. And she had a really good band with John Paricelli and Dudley Phillips and Ralph Salmons, I think, did it. Or Nick France, you know, on drums. Mm-hmm. It was a really good band and we did quite a lot of touring with that. So that was going on. I never recorded, actually. Well, I never recorded with them anyway. So that was happening with Loose Tubes. And then Loose Tubes finished. And then I kind of started to do my own thing a bit more, you know.
Had you done much of your own music before that?
No, not really. No. So it was quite late. I was quite late in doing my own. I mean, I was writing things and...
Yeah.
I had a little band.
Did you write for Loose Tubes at all?
I never wrote for Loose Tubes, okay. No.
But you're writing for other things.
I was writing for smaller groups, right. Yeah. So I had various quartets and things, you know, one quartet I had actually was with Steve Berry and Bosco. and Hugh Warren, which is a kind of little group that we had for a while, and we did a broadcast and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And then there was another band. And then I had a band called the Mark Lockhart Quartet with Hugh Warren, Dudley Phillips, and who was the drummer? Roy Dodds.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that band, and Hugh Warren had a band with three of the same people. He had a band with Dudley, yeah. me, and a different drummer.
Great.
And I think Dudley had a band
yeah.
with me, Hugh, and him.
Yeah.
And a different drummer. Richard Bailey, I think, was in Dudley's band. So we, the three of us had these bands that were incredibly similar. So we thought, why don't we put this thing together? And that's how Perfect Houseplants was formed.
Right.
Which was really important for me, that band.
Yeah.
For a long time. And that was my main outlet for writing.
Yeah.
After Loose Tubes, really, was that band. So the three of us wrote for it, Hugh, myself, and Dudley Phillips. And that was amazing, that band, you know, in terms of getting out and playing and writing and finding out how you, you know, work with a band and get tours and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So, and that was great. We did six albums with that band.
Oh, wow.
So it was around for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we still think about possibly doing something again, you know, at some point.
But yeah.
That finished probably about 10 years ago now.
Right. Why did it come to an end?
I don't know, really. We were just all started doing our own things, and I think I wanted to do something different, and Hugh was doing different stuff. And I mean, I've always worked a lot with Hugh in various things.
Yeah.
You know, I did, for years, I worked with him and June Tabor. It was an amazing, do you know who June Tabor is? She's an amazing folk singer.
Right.
And we did an awful lot of work with her. So, yeah, so Hugh and I have always had this very close musical thing.
Yeah.
And Houseplants was great fun, you know. We kind of just wrote music that we wanted to write. We didn't, I mean, this is quite weird, some of the music, you know.
Yeah.
But we never really worried about what people thought of it. We just did it, you know. And some people liked it, you know.
Yeah.
So it was great. And the records sound really good. I'm really proud of the records still, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I do things differently now, but at the time, we were lucky, you know, we got a record deal and we kind of recorded in nice studios and all things like that.
Yeah.
So it was really good, really good period.
Did you have, like, someone managing that as well?
No, we used to do it just between us. I mean, I used to do most of it, really.
Yeah.
I used to get the gigs and apply for funding and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's great. Great time, really.
Yeah.
A good time.
Yeah. It's really nice when, like with you and Hugh, you've got people within the like musical groups that you're playing with who you feel really, really well bonded with and connected with. And I think when you're studying, so much of that stuff is going on with, like, or at least that's how it is now, because I guess the people you play with, like, you tend to meet them in a controlled environment sometimes, like you're the first day of your new jazz course, and you meet the other guys in your year, and you're kind of eyeing them up being like, I'm gonna have to live with you for 4 years, you know. And but then that's a lot of time to play with someone to get to know how they play and what they like and what you like.
Yeah, and none of us met on a jazz course, you know.
Yeah.
We all met out on the scene doing gigs, really.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of glad of that, really. I don't know. It's nice. I'm quite glad I didn't study jazz at college.
Yeah.
You know, that. I mean, it sounds a slightly irresponsible thing to say, but for someone who teaches jazz at college.
Yeah.
But for me, I'm glad I didn't, you know, I'm glad I found it out my own way,
really,
a little bit. And, you know, I think some of us, we might not have got into colleges in those days, you know. I think we all played in a kind of quite eccentric way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I like that. I think it's really good that, you know.
Yeah.
So, but, I mean, someone like Hugh was, and still is, a real inspiration. You know, he just has a unique, his own unique way of playing. And, you know, he writes in a way that no one else writes. He's an amazing composer.
Yeah, I played Hugh. A load of his tunes on a project once, and they just thought, they all felt like something I'd not ever really seen before or heard before, the way they were written.
He's amazing. Yeah. I mean, he's obviously a jazz pianist, but he comes just as much from Brazilian music and folk music. You know, he's got all that thing in his playing.
Yeah.
He's got a kind of really unique thing going on.
Yeah. You
know? And I like that. I like that when jazz musicians take lots of things and they build their own identity from that.
Yeah.
I think that's more interesting in a way often than people just taking one style of music and, you know, just taking the jazz language and using that.
Yeah.
I think sometimes the more interesting things are people who have taken from a broader area, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That another guy we had on, Femi Tomoro, he's a guitarist, and he does that so nicely.
Mm.
Sometimes, like on his albums, like you can't hear a shred of like Western jazz harmony on some of it, you know, and just to have the self-control to stay within the style of the tunes is really cool, you know. Yeah, to have that, and like you say, it makes for very interesting music.
Yeah, and I think sometimes the great jazz musicians, they, you know, part of the reason why they were great is they found it their own way, and I think what makes people really good sometimes is the things they can't do as much as the things they can do, you know. And I think one of the
that's a very interesting, profound observation, because you know, as musicians, I'm always obsessed about the things I can't do and trying to do them.
Yeah, I mean, we all want to do everything brilliantly, but
yeah.
I think in art, it doesn't always work like that. You know, I think someone who, for example, you might have someone who's incredibly well equipped and can do lots and lots of things, you know, incredible facility and incredible everything and just all the facility. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean they can actually make interesting music.
Yeah.
You know, I think the thing about interesting music or the, you look at people like Monk or, you know, Wayne Shorter or Ornette or Earl Hines, you know, a lot of what makes them great is that they can't do everything. They can't play in every style.
Yeah.
You know, so they focus on what they can do.
Yeah.
And develop that. And then that becomes a kind of incredibly unique and profound concept in the case of those guys anyway.
Yeah. You know, this is good. This is changing my whole life attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're not used to this after all. I mean.
Yeah.
It's just the way I've been feeling, you know, the last few years about it, with doing lots of teaching and seeing people develop, and sometimes I just want people just to kind of lose all that technical thing, you know, all the knowledge and just do something else, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's nice in art, I think, you know.
Yeah.
That approach.
Yeah, I wrestled with that a lot at college. I remember Mike Walker saying to me, when you're on stage, don't push yourself above this kind of 60% of what you know you're capable of. I think he's probably scaled it down to 60 for me because I was kind of really out of control. But I used to love being sounding really like unpolished and messy, and that's part of the show of it. But, you know, because some are like Nadeem Tamori was at college with me, and he was unbelievably fluent technically and the most beautiful sound, you know. He was like the complete opposite to me. He was just so nice, so nice to listen to. But I could never really make my mind up. I still can't, how I sort of feel about that.
I guess you just have to decide what you like and what you want to sound like, you know. And
yeah.
I mean, I like both of those things. I like very polished playing and I like the abandonment and the kind of roughness sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, I've just been listening to a Jackie McLean album that I brought on vinyl. And I don't really know much about Jackie McLean, but it's pretty rough, some of it, you know, the sound, and but it's great, you know. Something about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then you listen to kind of Stan Getz or something, or Joe Lovano, and it's obviously very different, you know.
Yeah. Even sometimes with Getz, there's loads of, like, squeaks in there.
Yeah.
You know.
Getz isn't smooth always, is he?
No. I really like that, though.
Yeah.
That it's not filtered or, you know, that's just what it was. So that's what you get.
Yeah.
You know? If the reed was, like, a bit dodgy.
Yeah, especially later Getz. Yeah. Where he feels like he's fighting the setup a bit. You know, it's really nice that.
Yeah. So how do you feel about teaching jazz in conservatoires? Because you're teaching at Trinity.
Mm.
And you did a 1 hour or like a 2 hour composition class when I was at Academy one day.
Did I?
You did. Yeah. It was absolutely.
I'll say the word for it.
Yeah.
what was it like?
It was amazing.
Oh, was it? Oh,
yeah, it was absolutely brilliant.
Oh, that's a relief.
Well, you just talked about different ways of getting into composition, so you're not just staring at a blank page.
Okay. Okay.
Just threw some different ideas out there.
Okay.
Nothing really technically specific, you know.
Right. Just that sounds like me.
Yeah. But how is it, you know, from a teaching perspective, like getting loads of kids coming through and getting probably younger and better every year, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting, Rob. I mean, the standards, they are getting better in a way. They're getting better at playing their instruments.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say the level's much higher now than it was when I left college.
Yeah.
You know, everyone plays better in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, but I worry sometimes a little bit about whether the originality or the experimentation is there, you know, quite as much as it was. I mean, I don't know, that might just be me being a bit romantic about older times, but I do sometimes think people, it's a little safe, the jazz thing at the moment, you know.
Yeah.
I'd like to see people experimenting a bit more with it and you know, the art form moving on a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's obviously some great things going on. But going back to your question, yeah, so people, the standard's really high. A lot of people come from the same kind of social place a bit, which bothers me a little bit, which is a bit controversial, but as I've started, I'll carry on. There's a lot of this thing with people coming from, you know, Cheatham's and Purcell School and kind of specialist schools.
Yeah.
And obviously they're highly skilled in terms of a lot of the things that you need for the language, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they come into the colleges. So I think it's very weighted, the colleges, in the intake that the colleges have in London. It's very weighted with musicians like that.
Yeah.
Who are very good
musicians
who have a lot of things together. But it feels like there's a bit of a void for people who aren't on that same wavelength.
Yeah.
Who play music, i.e. people perhaps who don't have such good harmonic skills, such good, you know, all kinds of skills, you know.
Yeah.
They might not play the instrument as well. They might not read very well.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it feels a little bit that in this country we might be missing a bit of a trick. You know, there might be some really interesting musicians out there who are not getting into colleges because we have such a high academic criteria.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, so I mean, much to the standard that you need to be at when you're 18 is obscenely high. You need to have known for a long time that that's what you're going to do.
Yeah.
And practiced really hard.
Yeah.
And then I think the way I feel about it is that, because I went to a music school, and when I got to the Royal Northern, I was kind of acutely aware of looking at the fourth years that quite often the kids who got in on reserve places were usually the best.
Mm.
And the kids that came from music school had either kind of, I've got this lifelong obsession with over practicing to compensate for my own lifetime spent not quite doing enough.
Mm.
But quite often people would, who, you know, the roles would have completely reversed, where the best ones at the start would have not pushed hard enough to carry on that way. And I think, like, lucky for those, there's a friend of mine called Tom Taylor. He is a pianist. He studied at Trinity on the jazz postgrad course. He got a reserve place at the Northern and then was lucky to get in.
Mm.
And then obviously is really driven to make the most of that opportunity and go to Trinity. And now he's a incredibly successful pianist.
Mm.
But had someone not, or had someone taken their place who then didn't, he could well have not ever gone down this path. You know, it's just so lucky.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's loads of people like him who obviously we don't know about, who have been forgotten about, who just because they weren't quite good enough aged 18 have been pushed down a different path. But give it, you know, a couple more years or...
Yeah.
You don't know.
No, I think that's... I think it's a good point. You know, I think there are... It's very hard to get into colleges. And as you say, you need to be at such a high level.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, I think about what it would be like with art school, you know, because I feel that jazz... Studying jazz should be a bit like going to art school.
Yeah.
It should be about concepts and it should be about ideas and your personal approach. And it feels that it's not a lot of the time. It feels like it's about skills, you know, a skill set.
Yeah. I mean, my audition for the Royal Academy, if ever you wanted to talk about skill set, you know, it was like so specific. Like you play the A, take the A train, two choruses, out you go. And then if they come back, then there's like a, then there's two more tunes and you have to pick one of those and you've got to be able to play a blues in 12 keys, but it's really specific. So you get pushed into those loops, whether you want it or not, because if I know that I'm going to have to audition and it clearly says, we might ask you rhythm changes in all keys. We might ask you blues in all keys. I'm immediately like, crap, I've got to do all that stuff now, you know? But it doesn't, I suppose, no, you do take your own composition. So there is an element of conceptualized, being expected to have a lot of very, what I would consider very difficult technical achievements under your belt in case you're on the fence and they want, like, let's play a blues in A flat, you know, that'd floor me now.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we need to remember it's an art form and not a sport, you know.
Yeah. I've always hated that personally with like, with being really specific with your practice about learning licks and learning lines and putting them in. I mean, I know there's a place for it, but I just can't stand it. F***ing off so much, you know, it doesn't feel free enough for my personal tastes.
Yeah.
Although I could have, I can hear Nick Smart's voice now lecturing me about the merits of having some language for when you're actually improvising.
Well, I think you need language, yeah. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, the legitimate language. It doesn't have to be someone else's language. It can be your language.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I think method is really important. I think everyone needs a method, but often I think you acquire a method from lots of different things, you know, from lots of places and lots of observation. And I think, you know, sometimes that's not acknowledged enough. You know, we're all meant to follow. It's a bit like education, you know, system. You're all meant to be the same and you're all meant to be channeled in the same way and you're all meant to be able to do the same things. You know, I think music is even less like that, you know, and certainly jazz is even less like that.
Yeah.
You know, so the trouble with putting jazz in an educational institution is how do you cater for individuals? You know, it's the same challenge in mainstream education, but in a music college, it's a real challenge.
Yeah.
I think. you know, and there's always the danger that you're going to stifle people's eccentricities that actually make the music interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that I wrestle with all the time.
Yeah.
With my teaching. I mean, yeah. I love teaching. I love going in and teaching. And, you know, I probably really enjoyed the thing that I did with you. You know, if I could remember it.
Do you know, I've got it recorded somewhere.
Have you?
I recorded every class.
Okay.
Because I just couldn't take studious. Any. I was so overwhelmed.
Yeah.
By the speed of it and the speed of everyone else's learning. I would just start putting my iPhone on every class.
Yeah, well, that's
I've
brilliant.
I've got that somewhere.
That's a brilliant thing
like, my whole master's is in an archive.
So you've got all Pete's lectures.
Yeah. I used to leave my phone on and go home.
Wow.
Come in at 9 till 11 and do the first year class.
Mm.
Leave my iPhone recording. And tell Pete I'd be back for it at 5:30 and I'd come back for it then. And then I've done like 8 or 9 hours of lectures. But I just got to the point so quickly where I couldn't process anything else.
Mm.
We do first year harmony, then second year harmony, then third year harmony. And those year groups on the undergrad course, they've had a whole year to get from that class to the next point, you know, whereas for us, you then just make a huge jump up.
Mm.
Like on the master's course, you just go to whatever you wanted, essentially. And yeah, I just was deeply confused. and still am. But yeah, to come, I guess it'd be really, like you say, to come in for 2 hours and just talk about composition and, you know, share some ideas, you know, that's a really nice.
It's funny because actually, that's what I'm going to be doing in a few hours' time today.
Oh, cool.
I'm doing a class. It's the first class. It's called Introduction to Jazz Composition. And it's with postgrads.
Yeah.
A two-hour class.
Great. Where?
At Trinity today. But,
right, cool.
But I was thinking yesterday, the reason why I mentioned this is I was thinking how best to approach this, you know.
Yeah.
And I've started to write quite a lot of stuff out. But what I'm really interested in is trying to get the students to come up with their own method. So what I'm going to try and do is point them to things and show them things and ultimately try and get them to find a way of working that they feel good about.
That's exactly what you did.
It was
brilliant. You just load of different ideas of ways you can get started if you're not getting anywhere.
Mm.
And then I went away and tried them.
Mm.
And one that you said, like, just put your phone on and record yourself improvising and then go back and listen to it and try and pick parts of it that you like and build a composition on it.
Mm.
And it just got me playing more and ideas are going and then you can sit down and more analysing what you've already done as opposed to trying to create something mentally, you know, playing on the instrument. And it just made loads of sense. I was immediately like, this feels right. I will do this more.
Brilliant.
And it was funny, on that whole 2 years, that was the only 2 hours we spent together.
Yeah, yeah.
But it really kick-started my ability to write stuff. And it was a really simple idea.
Yeah, yeah.
But just because it's simple doesn't make it any less obvious if you haven't already thought about it. You know?
Well, that's good to know. So it'll be the same old shit this afternoon. But, you know, I want them to... I think, you know, just going back to this method about playing, whether you play or write, I think that's really important. I don't think you get good by... you know, just kind of yachting around and, you know, as we know, you know, a student isn't going to develop just by being unfocused. So I think you have to be incredibly focused.
Yeah.
I wouldn't ever say that you didn't need to be focused. You
know? Yeah.
It's just finding something that, a method that resonates with you, you know.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I feel about education, I suppose. Very long-winded answer to that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting for jazz because it's changed so much.
Yeah.
And continues to change that, it's something that is always a fun topic to sit and have a chat about.
Mm. I mean, what I can't do, actually, is teach and then do a gig. It never really works very well for me.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So I tend to keep my day free if I've got a gig.
Right.
You know, to build up to the gig.
Yeah.
Rather than go and teach. I mean, it didn't used to be possible. You know,
yeah.
It's like when you're running around trying to do everything.
Yeah.
But I realized that my brain isn't in the right place if I've been teaching.
Right.
A lot, you know, to go and then do a gig.
It just
doesn't work.
Yeah.
I feel too, I get to the gig and I'm too analytical or something, you know.
Yeah.
Not in the zone.
Yeah.
So that's been quite a valuable lesson, actually.
Yeah. Do you remember, like, figuring that out one day, kind of playing and being like, that's what's wrong here?
Yeah. I just remember thinking, I'm not focused or I'm not relaxing enough.
Yeah.
You know, because for me, when I improvise, I'm not really thinking about, I don't want to think about how I'm doing it. I just want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and when you're teaching, you having to think about how you do it and explain.
Mm.
So it's probably a left, right side
type
thing, isn't it?
I can do that to myself when I listen to jazz. I can ruin it if I start making a big effort.
Yeah.
So even if I think about how weird it is, the fundamental act of improvising, I can start then to completely like not enjoy the music because I can be like, this is weird. Like, what are we all doing? Mm. You know, got to not have that when you're listening.
Yeah. No. I mean, yeah, it's an incredibly complex thing, isn't it? When you try and work out what you hear when you listen to music.
Yeah.
Sometimes you listen to it on a subconscious level. Other times you're analysing some of it.
Yeah.
I mean, this the whole thing is different for every person, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people just enjoy music on a subconscious level and they're not interested in how it's put together, and that's fine, isn't it?
Yeah. Let's finish by talking about the Printmakers.
Printmakers? Nikki's band? Yeah, that's very nice. Have you seen the band?
I have, yeah.
Yeah.
It's quite a while ago that I saw it, actually.
Yeah. No, the Printmakers is really nice. I mean, it's really lovely for me to be playing with Norma Winston, you know, who I've always loved.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a bit of a kind of legend, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, that's lovely. And I've known Nikki for a long time, long time, you know. Going back to Steve Berry days, Nikki and I used to play together a lot.
Yeah.
And with Mike, actually. I've known Mike for quite a long time.
Mike Walker.
Although we haven't played together that much. But yeah, it's a lovely band. It's a band of kind of understatement and...
Mm.
But also lots of fireworks as well. On a good gig, it goes pretty nuts, you know. It's really nice. But it's Nikki's music, some of Nikki's music and songs that Norma's written the words to, quite a lot of that, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a band I really enjoy.
How long has it been going now?
I don't know, about seven or eight years.
Yeah.
Something like that. I mean, it's kind of one strand of what I do, you know. I mean, I want to try and do more. I want to write more music, you know. I'm always writing music, but I want to write more of my own music. And,
yeah.
You know, do more of that. But the Printmakers is a really nice thing to go alongside that, you know.
Yeah. So you say you want to write more of your own music. Does that mean like starting more projects to air it in, or is there like existing things that you think that you just like to be writing more for?
Existing things.
Yeah.
So there's the trio I've got with Liam Noble and Jasper Hoiby, which is a big thing. I've just been mixing that, a new album with that.
Oh, cool.
So, and we all write for that.
Do you mix that yourself?
I don't mix it. No, I mix it with an
engineer. Like an engineer, yeah.
Yeah. And then I've got an Ellington project that I want to do another record with and another tour with that, of taking Ellington's music and basically destroying it.
Yeah.
Deconstructing it rather than destroying it.
Yeah.
And then there's this orchestral jazz thing that I'm doing. So, you know, I've always got something on the go yeah. in terms of writing.
I read a really interesting interview that you'd done last week. It better have been you or else I'm about to make a massive dick out of myself. About like doing standards gigs.
Oh yeah, no, it was. Yeah. It was yeah. The gig at the 606, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. Mm. And kind of, I found it really interesting about kind of the act of playing standards and trying to make them still feel kind of like when I play standards, I'd love it if I could make them feel the way it feels to play my own music,
mm.
to sort of have slightly more ownership of them. But I think that's laziness on my part, you know, to just, I'll play it in four in the key it was in.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's not about necessarily changing the key or the tempo. It's more, I guess, it's more interpretation of the melody and the song. That's the thing that I'm interested in,
right?
And that's probably one of the reasons why I've never done an album of standards yet.
Yeah, just
because it's actually quite hard
for me. That's the last thing in the world I would want to try and do.
Right.
It'd be terrifying.
I mean, I'd love to do it.
Yeah.
And I'd really love to do it, and I will do it at some point. But yeah. it terrifies me a bit as well.
Just, yeah.
Just coming out with something that is worth coming out with, you know, because there's so much of that music that is ultimately perfect, you know.
Yeah,
so many records I've got hundreds of records of that
music
that I listen to a lot, and
yeah,
it's almost too precious really to kind of dabble with it
and yeah
do something good with,
like you were talking about advancing the art form. It's hard to merge those two things of dealing with standards and furthering the art form, I think.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, for me, it wouldn't necessarily be too much about furthering the art form. It sounds pretentious, doesn't it? I would be happy if I could do it in a way that was totally me and I didn't try and copy other people. You know, if I could do it that way and I could get to the beginning, from the beginning to the end of the record in a way that was me playing and totally me, I'd probably be happy with it. You know, it's that thing that there's so many stylistic references for me with all those tunes that, you know, that I, going back to the time I played along with them, I spent hours playing along to these records, you know.
Yeah.
Stan Getz, Phil Woods, I'd just put them on and I'd, you know. So, even though when I improvise, with my own music, that doesn't come out. It does tend to come out a bit if I'm playing standards, you know, all these stylistic things that I've absorbed.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting till I get to the point that I can just do it completely in my own way.
Yeah. That's a nice thing to have waited a long time to create.
Yeah, I'm quite excited about it. And the other week when I did that standards gig that the interview was about, I really enjoyed that gig. It was really good, and I feel like I'm getting closer to that.
Yeah.
You know, much closer to that, to getting to that level.
Yeah.
That stage.
Yeah.
I
like the idea of this. This does sound pretentious. This alternate musical journey of learning standards when you're first starting out, and then a whole career of your own music, and you kind of striving to, you know, do a standards album.
Still, I know, it's bizarre, isn't it? When you look at it that way, it should be the first thing you do. I mean, I think with some players, it is the first thing they do, and then and then they do their own music. But for me, it was the other way around, really.
Yeah.
You know, probably because I was lucky enough to be involved in bands that were creating their own music, you know, like Loose Tubes and Houseplants and Polar Bear. And, you know, so I think I got that bug that it was nice actually to explore your own music.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, really? What a privilege to be able to do that, you know, to be playing music for people.
Yeah, definitely. We are very fortunate.
You know, you forget that sometimes, you know. No one owes you. No one owes you a living, you know.
Yeah.
You have to try and provide something that people are going to want to listen to, you know?
Yeah. That's where it always goes wrong for me.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Mark, thanks so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
Oh, good. I hope that's right. I hope it's not too negative.
No, it's fantastic. It's great. I'm sure everyone will enjoy listening to that. Because I would. I enjoyed listening.
Oh, good, good. Thanks, Rob. Nice to do it. Brilliant.
So I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Mark Lockhart. I'm looking forward to hearing how this actually comes out with Rob leaving little messages. You doing all right there, Rob?
Yeah, good.
Good. So next week we have Jim Hart, is that right?
That's the one. Oh, Jim.
Good, yeah, that's right. We've got Jim Hart coming on episode 17. We're closing in on the end of the season, episode 24. We need to have something kind of good for that, don't we, Rob?
Yeah, cake or something.
How do you like the sound of my voice actually today? Lydia, I'm doing this from my wife Lydia, does voiceovers and she's been building a little studio in our cupboard. Does it sound good? We've got a new microphone.
It sounds like you're whispering into my ear, gently.
Great. Well, maybe I'll be in here from now on.
Yeah, it's very disconcerting, actually.
Upgrading the Jazz Podcast. What have you got planned the rest of your trip?
Going to Columbus today, then Montgomery, Mobile, and then New Orleans.
Cool. Oh, well, enjoy and say hi to Claire.
Yeah, I will.
A lovely day, everyone, Jazz Podcast listeners, and I'll leave a little gap for Rob to say his little piece.
Until Friday. That'll do.